Bosnia.
This is not going to be easy.
Let's talk about Immigration Nation. How did that come about?
I made friends in ICE, and they really loved that I'd come off spending time on the Mexican side. Trump's election was somewhat of a surprise. Immigration was a hot potato, and suddenly ICE became the boogeyman.
I don't care what you do, but bring at least two people in.
Your boss might say this one day, and the next day he's like, I don't have space for anybody.
Sometimes the kids were completely separated from any parent, and then it wasn't being recorded properly, so they ultimately became lost. Whatever happened with that, and was it really like that?
It was really hard. For our journalists, you are behind the camera because you are there to witness this.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. So we have heard a lot about immigration in the last couple of weeks now that Trump has taken office again. And I wanted to have two people on that I know more about this subject than anyone I can possibly imagine speaking to. My friends Shaul Schwartz and his wife Christina Clouseau are award-winning documentary filmmakers and photojournalists. Together, they co-directed the Netflix series Immigration Nation, which provides a detailed and often unsettling look at the U.S. immigration system. The series offers rare access to ICE operations, the experiences of immigrants, and the broader consequences of immigration policies. Shaul and Christina are known for their raw and unflinching storytelling, often focusing on complex and controversial topics like wildlife conservation, as seen in Trophy, and now Immigration. Their work aims to provoke discussion and shed light on issues often misunderstood or overlooked. This interview is a powerful opportunity to explore the evolving challenges in immigration today. Please enjoy my conversation with Shaul and Christina. Shaul and Christina, I'm so happy to see you guys again. Thank you for joining me on Misunderstood.
Thanks for having.
So guys, I have so much to talk to you about immigration, because I feel like you have been on the inside and know all about the stuff. We've been hearing all about it through the media, but I think it's really important to hear from you guys. But before we get to that, I find you guys fascinating as individuals and as a couple. So can you start by telling our listeners and viewers how you got into filmmaking and how you guys also met?
You want to start?
No, go ahead. You have a longer history.
Well, we're both coming from print journalism and photography. Both are photographers. Essentially, we met through that community. I was working as a freelance photographer a lot for Time magazine. Christina was a photo editor there, but even before then, we just knew each other from that community. And back in 2013, I was starting to switch towards documentary filming. And me and Christina kind of met. She was dating someone I knew, and then she wasn't dating him anymore. And I kind of became free and we clicked. And pretty quickly after, my first film, Narcocultura, got made, Christina and I kind of looked at each other and said, this is, unlike still photography, this is a team effort. Can we actually live and play on the same roof? And it was exciting and scary, and we gave it a shot and opened a production company and has done a lot. It's been a crazy roller coaster ever since.
Right. Is that your same version, Christina?
Pretty much. I mean, I was in print journalism before, and I studied photography, and then I decided to go into working at Time magazine for a number of years, and that's where I met Shaul, and he kind of pulled me over. I think at that point I was like, okay, I'm ready to leave New York unless I can actually be more in the field and work more creatively, and he pulled me over to the film side, and so let's work together. And started back, I think 2014 is when we opened the first office.
Right. So what were some of the first projects you had pitched or even that came to fruition? What were you guys working on?
We did a lot of shorts, short documentaries. We did a lot of short content, mainly for magazines online. So Time, for New Yorker, for who else did we work with?
Nat Geo.
Geo.
Basically, it was this time that the internet was flourishing, actually, and video cameras kind of like were making it more easy for people like us who are in the field to create shorts. So we are like just excited by that opportunity of kind of being the voice as well.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, we kind of like, and our clients wore these online publications, the magazines and the newspapers. And it's actually one of those projects that ended up leading in a weird way to Immigration Nation. And but yeah, as I'd say of 2017, we started making films that are feature length films and shows. And ever since then, we've made, let's see, three feature. Yeah, we've made a couple of feature length films and two shows.
And how do you pitch? How do you come up with your topics? Is it something that you guys pitch or a network comes to you and says, we want you guys to give this a shot?
It's a little bit of both. Our first documentary that we worked on together, that we directed together, is called Trophy. And that was back in 2017. That's an idea that we came up with. And we found independent financing and was able to create it and then sell it through festivals.
And what was Trophy about for people that are listening?
Trophy is about big game hunting, looking at it from a very economical standpoint. And so it brings a bunch of characters both on the hunting side and the non-hunting side together to kind of have a very interesting approach. A lot of our work deals with, you know, subjects that maybe the viewer thinks they know about, and then we try and flip it on their head.
Right.
So we never really want to provide answers, but instead ask a lot of questions.
Right. So was this a topic that really interested you, or how did you even come up
with it? Yeah, it started with an argument at our kitchen because I didn't grow up hunting. I grew up in Israel. Christina grew up in northern Minnesota. And I was just flipping on a phone, I think, and I saw a picture of some lady posing with a giraffe she just shot. And I was like, oh, you know, just cursing at her. And Christina kind of giggled and she said, yeah, what? Like, so what? Just another big game hunter. And we got into an argument and I was like, and I think her caption read something to the essence of helping conserve. And I was like, how can you kill something and conserve it, lady? What the, you're full of shit kind of thing. And that argument and the raw feelings, but also the fact that the idea of conservation and hunting I was not familiar with, that was a perfect entry segue for us because yeah, like Christina said, that's what we like. We kind of like to take issues that are controversial, that people think they know stuff about, get extraordinary good access. That's our must. We don't do anything that we don't feel like we've really got there.
Right.
And then not answer, but create an argument. Let people say, oh my God, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Am I closed-minded? Am I open-minded? And many times we're conflicted about the subjects we do. I think that was the case in Immigration. You know, there has, as we developed, there has been shows, you know, we came off doing a Sean White show and we just did a show about base jumping, which I'd say brought some of that style, but not all of it. But when it's in the social political kind of aspects, we do really kind of like to poke at questions and bring you closer so you take your own decision.
Right. So let's talk about Immigration Nation. How did that come about?
It actually came out very in those early days when we were working for Time. I pitched a video project. I was working. My first movie was called Narcocultura. It was about the drug war in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And really what I like to say, the Mexican-American drug war, because that whole thing is entangled in each other, right? The money.
Right.
And drugs come up, the weapons go down, and the border is open, and we go across. And that movie broke, and it released in Sundance, and people took notice to the fact that I'm willing to take a lot of risk as a conflict photographer and be in this zone. And through that, I'd met an ICE spokesman in Arizona who I asked about doing something. You know, ICE is more famous for what is called ERO, the Side Enforcement Removal Operation is the acronym. That's what people associate ICE with.
Okay.
It also has a side of the house called HSI, Homeland Security Investigation. Mm-hmm. HSI, in layman's term, is really more like a special, almost FBI. They deal with anything that crosses the border illegally, but it's really a lot of drugs. It could be anything that's not paying customs. It could be stolen art. A lot of drugs, though, are a main, and human smuggling and human trafficking. Mm-hmm. So I'd met the spokesman, and really, I was very much in the drug world and being in Culiacan and embedding with the Sinaloa cartel. And I'd never done it from the U.S. side, meaning was U.S. special forces such as HSI or DEA. Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, he kind of said yes. That is a side that ICE has always traditionally been a little bit more open about. I'd say it's a little less controversial. And Time Magazine commissioned me to do a piece, and it was pretty extraordinary access. And in that couple of days that I spent in Arizona, I ended up documenting, busting some cells of the Sinaloa cartel moving drugs into the country. Mm. And the operation kind of grew because of the intelligence they had gathered. Mm-hmm. And so 6 months later, I came back and we had this extraordinary story. And in fact, the access was so extraordinary that Time didn't publish it. They were worried about the fact that I was in different houses and how things are done. And I was really bummed. And I actually thought that ICE would be pretty upset with me because they'd spend time and energy, and it really wasn't my fault. We'd cut together a beautiful short film.
Sure.
But the short of it is I made friends in ICE, and they really loved that the people in the field really, really, because they were so in the drug world and knew that I'd come off spending time on the Mexican side, mm-hmm. had a lot of respect, and I had a lot of respect for the people I met. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of surprising how much of a friendship. And then I asked the spokesman if me and Christina could actually do the more known side of ICE, immigration. Now, keep in mind, this is Obama days. This is when most of the Republican Party is thinking, how do we change our stance on immigration? The youth is growing. We should be more tolerant. We're going to lose elections because of this. It's a very different time. The country has changed substantially. Hmm. And basically, the answer from ICE was, no, this doesn't make sense. This is a hot potato. You guys are hard-hitting journalists. Giving you good access would just be too controversial.
Sure.
Nobody is really complaining enough. And then fast forward, me and Christina are sitting in Sundance with our film Trophy. Trump has been elected. And we're brainstorming what's next in this like endless thing of like when you create something and it comes out and you say, you'll never do it again. I don't want the pain. And here you are wanting it again. And we suddenly thought, maybe we should go back to ICE. Because in the Obama days, they didn't have a lot of heat, but it was clear that they would get some heat. And they did know us. And we were becoming a wholesale name and had relationships at this point with mm-hmm. major buyers. And we did, and that's kind of how Immigration Nation got off to a start.
So did you pitch the idea first to Netflix, or you created the entire project and then they bought it? How does that work?
We started it's called development. So okay. We actually found independent financing to spend 6 months developing the project. And in terms of development, you shoot for a while, you edit a sizzle reel or a string out, and you put together a pitch deck, and then you go and pitch it to Netflix. And so in this case, we brought it to, I think, Netflix.
Yeah, we brought it to Netflix, and it kind of happened organically, but we were definitely in and had the access while.
So it wasn't hard to get somebody on board. They were like, they saw it, they got it. They're like, let's do this.
Yes. I'd say that. you know, again, looking back, of course, it was hard and a lot of work and editing and stuff, but there was excitement about the project because of the access and I think our credibility from the get-go.
Right. So what do you think changed about ICE wanting to give you the access at this point? They, from before when they were like, absolutely not, this is a hot potato, to, yeah, I want you in there embedded and so you can see everything that's going on.
You mean in 218? Why did they suddenly?
Yeah.
Because there was they were taking a lot of heat. You know, Trump's election was somewhat of a surprise and immigration was a hot potato and suddenly ICE became the boogeyman.
Right.
And, you know, that was our pitch to them. Look, we'll be fair and this is a complicated issue. And
at this time, this was obviously when people were being deported, but was this a time when it became a huge issue where kids were being separated from their parents and put in cages or whatever they...
That was a couple of months into already having a show and sold to Netflix. So the access actually started getting negotiated as Trump, in the early... Or it's been a couple of years, so an exact timeline. But it was before children's separation policy was signed into effect. When that happened, we were already a full throttle of production for Netflix.
And so you were in there. You could see all this...
Yes.
Taking place.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I want to get to that. So like, let's just start with the access now, because if people have seen Immigration Nation, they will know, as you said, you had amazing access. Almost in some parts, you're like, I can't even believe they are filming this. This is incredible that they're there when some of this is happening, which is what makes it so great. And, you know, so talk to me about what that was like. Where were you guys? How long did this take? Like, give me a little bit of the details of what you had to go through.
It was about a 3-year project in production. And we kind of, at the beginning, we were able to have, they allowed us to have a ton of access in the sense that we had different ideas of different storylines that we wanted to pursue around immigration and around ERO and HSI. And so with each one of those, we were able to go to different locations and we kind of started mapping out across the country which sections of immigration represent which section of the country and how can we tell those stories through different angles. And the majority of it was going with ICE agents, following their daily lives, following the different sects of enforcement removalist operation. In New York, we worked with a team called Fugitive Ops, where they were the ones that were going out with warrants for individuals that were having criminal offenses. We also went to the non-detained docket, where it's those that are adjusting their immigration status are checking in on a daily, monthly, weekly basis, but they aren't being detained. And then in other parts of the country, in El Paso, we worked a lot with the detention center and on the border. And in Ballston, we work in Ohio, we worked with refugees. And so there was a number of different strategic places that we were looking at with relevant news stories. And so that was actually kind of how we structured the project. Mm-hmm. So we had one side of us, which we had the access to ICE and we followed their daily lives. And on the other side, what we started talking about early on is that the way that this is really going to be effective is to have an inside-outside perspective, that you're on the inside with ICE, but you have to understand the people's lives on the outside too. The families of those being detained, the cross-cultural, the cross-border, what is actually going on in their families' lives while they're being detained, and so on and so forth.
Right.
That was really kind of the idea around it.
So something that's interesting to me, there's one specific shot where it seems like you guys must be in the back seat and then one of the ICE guys takes a phone call and it's on speakerphone and the guy says, okay, just bring in you have to come in with X amount of people today. I don't care what you do, this amount of people. This is when you turn on the TV, that's what they're talking about again now, today, that they have to bring in 1,000 people a day, whatever it is. And he was like, I can't believe that he knows you guys are with me. I can't believe he would say that out loud. What are your thoughts on the fact that here we are again? They've made claims that they're only going after people who are a detriment, who are criminals. But is that what you found back then? I mean, it seemed like the people that you were following, a lot of them seemed like law abiding, not citizens, but law-abiding people. So what are your thoughts on all that?
It's a lot to break down in that question. Look, I'd call that the point you're describing the numbers game. Mm-hmm. And let me back up. I think ICE agents are a mix of, like any big agency, there's great people, there's less good people, and it's an opinion. Generally, they do their job. And I was a soldier. And when soldiers train, they train for conflict, they train to do something, they train to get a mission, and they're excited to get that mission. That's why they're there. They want to play. I don't actually blame the soldier so much. That's how he's been programmed. And unless he really breaks the law and does something terrible. So I think it makes sense that, yeah, people want to play the numbers game. How many did I catch? Mm-hmm. Especially if the tone from kind of trickling down is that tone. You know, I think in fugitive ops, the people who do that in New York, that unit that you mentioned, there was a mix. There were people who kind of felt emboldened and definitely got excited by how many we can catch today. And maybe, in my opinion, lost perspective of that these are people. Now, look, you could argue about the politics. Some people, mostly that unit in those times, would try to go after people who are broken the law by coming in unlawfully, but have also had a criminal offense. Mm-hmm. Some more serious, some less serious, but they usually weren't like, you know, didn't stop at a stop sign. There were usually actually offenses. And I think that's not that controversial. If right. somebody, however, what happens if you walk into that house and encounter five other people?
Right. The collaterals. Yeah.
So, you know, and that just varied. And I think as we definitely saw as time went by, this many, many people getting swept into the number game. And I would say we saw some officers that weren't. Now, as the environment changes and everybody wants to go into that number game, if you're that ICE officer or that lady that wants to just catch that criminal and not threaten his brother or his mother, do you get shit from the other guys? How does that, you know? And then the thing about immigration that people don't understand is everything is kind of complicated in this random thing. You might want to arrest a lot of people, but if you have nowhere to put him, for example, then your boss might say this one day and the next day he's like, I don't have space for anybody. I'm actually going to let go of the people you caught yesterday because I can't deport that guy. That is this kind of weird, sad, depressing thing in this system. But per the number game, I definitely think that in the first Trump era, something changed. And I'm not in ICE now, but I can assume the emboldenedness of like getting numbers is high.
Yeah.
And they are very bluntly saying that I don't really care. Yeah, first of all, let's get rid of the criminals. But if you are just in here illegally, we should deport you. And if we catch you, I mean, seeing is believing. It's a hard thing to achieve. Mm-hmm. I also think like it's very early, but we're actually seeing them say at least, well, you might be here technically legally, like temporary protective status, but that was illegal of the Biden administration to let you be here legally. So we're going to install some fear into here. Maybe we can take you now. Again, these things will get challenged in court and not. So we'll see how the numbers game go. Mm-hmm. But per agents, I sadly think that a lot of them did fall into losing a little bit perspective more and more and more. And I personally blamed them less than the tone that was set.
Right. No, I get it. So what is the process that you guys witnessed? They would take someone from their home. Where would they go? And could they sit there for months until they got deported? I mean, we're hearing now that planes are being diverted and they're not taking the people back home. How does that work?
Yeah, usually when somebody is detained by ICE, they're taken to a facility where they're processed, which is a local office. And then at that point, they're being held there for a couple days or a couple hours, and then they're being moved to a detention facility. Mm-hmm. In those detention facilities, they can be there for a month, they can be there for a year. It all depends on how their status or not status is, and where they are in the process. So if they have a pending court date or if they have a final order of removal, is all these things that come into effect, and that kind of affects how long they will stay. or if they're willing to voluntarily depart. If they're going to fight their case, they may fight their case from in the detention center, and others may eventually be released into the public with an ankle bracelet or some sort of digital monitoring waiting for their court dates. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I think each case is individual. Each individual is an individual thing. But there's a lot of arbitrariness in it, too. Sometimes because there isn't enough beds, they'll be released people just that they were going to keep for a long time. They'll just release them back into the public, or they'll deport them. And so it's kind of, there's, I think there's a systematic thing that happens, but a lot of times it feels like it's different.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The irony, of detention centers are technically not jails. They look like one. They feel like one. Some, you know, you could argue who gets treated worse or better. But technically, you're waiting a procedure. You haven't been judged. You're either waiting for immigration court. You're waiting for
deportation,
an order of removal. And I can't stress enough how arbitrary that can be. It's just like detention centers have needs. Like if you're near the border where we had access to a detention center in El Paso, Texas, it just depends how many people got caught and who wants to release them today. And what's, can I bust 100 bodies that way and that way? It just becomes this kind of mayhem, in honesty.
So it's not set up with like beds and people to be there for a while and a lot of.
It is.
It's
limited, right? ICE in general throughout, and it's mainly private contractors who actually do this, and it costs the taxpayer a ton of money, by the way. Set up all this thing. But if you're catching hundreds or thousands of people a day in a border, you're going to run out of space extremely quickly, which is why there's a thing called catch and release, something that the administration hates. I can understand them on that point. But you need an ability to process cases or to be able to deport people. For example, if people are coming through the Mexican border, if they're Mexican, you could deport them back to Mexico. If they're from Venezuela, you can't deport them.
Right.
So things get kind of complicated. So if you run out of space, you know, this is one of the arguments of what will be. Are we going to see mass? I mean, it's a charged word, but mass concentration camps kind of being built that are not permanent jails, that are not, or permanent detention centers. Sorry. I don't know. You know, those are, but essentially those are very expensive. And beds are give or take. I think at least when we were in the game, the capacity was at very, very top, close to 50,000 at any given day.
Wow.
Which is a lot of people, but the need is bigger. So that's right. Where the idea of like, okay, let's prioritize people who have committed serious offenses rather than, you know, Joe Schmo that
right,
has just been everyone. Here or certainly... you know, there's a lot of like, he's been here for 15 years and he's actually a program, but he didn't stop at a stop sign.
Right. Right. I mean, it's interesting because in the news, you just hear about these numbers. So of course, people that are pro all of this are like, oh, this is great, but they don't hear the part about, well, wait, where are they going? And there's this catch and release if they don't have the spots. And you know, I'm curious about the treatment of these people when they're in these detention centers. Are they being treated humanely?
I mean, generally what we saw, yes. I mean, I think there's grays in all of it, but I think generally, at least from our experience in the specific detention center in El Paso, yes.
Okay, well, that's good.
So I want to complicate that. I agree with Christina that the people we saw for the most part, treat them very humanely. However, as I said, at that point, they haven't committed most of them an offense. So it becomes debatable, right? Because what we saw, for example, is policy being implemented. So yes, the ICE persona did the best they can. But if your policy is to take and separate families, there's only one detention center that can hold women and children.
Okay.
And you took someone who his only offense is as a family to cross the border and separate that family for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't even bring a claim against them because the immigration system is so backed up and broken. Maybe the ICE officer is treated, and you're shuffled in that system. You have no access to nothing. You do not know anything. So yes, maybe they're being treated humane in the way they're being held. But I could argue that that's a complicated humane question.
Right. Okay. That's a really good, interesting answer. So let's talk about that separation for a second. What did you guys witness there? What I remember us hearing was that these people were being separated. Sometimes the kids were completely separated from any parent, and then it wasn't being recorded properly. So they ultimately became lost. Whatever happened with that? And was it really like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the policy comes down, right? And I think as everything in the first era of Trump, it seemed to be more surprised and less planned. I think they've slightly changed for good and bad. And I remember having very good relationships with the head of the detention center. And, you know, when you do such a thing, it's going to immediately affect people that have to actually do it on the field. How are we going to do it? Where are the beds? What's going to move? What's the military? What's the plan? This got announced, nobody at the detention center, I'm talking like head of the detention center, not like a little person. He was like, I didn't know anything. I heard it in the news.
Wow.
So there was immediate frustration to, okay, but what are we going to do? I think what I remember is hearing from some ICE agents who I would say are more on the right kind of let's go after them side. Loving the idea that it installs fear.
And it deters.
The deterrence is a tactic that some find very angering, some find very useful. This administration clearly, and the people who are leading it, the Holmans, the Millers, it's a tool they like to use. I think they would actually agree with me. Installing fear. If that gets on the news, if I separate, if I dare do this, then you're going to stop coming. Mm-hmm. If you have to, I'll give you another example. If we close parts of the border, now you have to endure walking 60 miles in the desert, and you see that some people die, there's a negative in that. Oh my God, people are dying for this. That's also a positive in their eyes because this is the price. Now you choose. Mm. So I think there was a lot of chaos is what we saw. I think people didn't know what was going. I think they were surprised. I think because the system was not prepped, there was certainly people who got lost. There was unclarity when it's going to be, Trump ended up reversing that after the pressure. I can't remember if it was 6, 7, 8 weeks or so.
Right.
But everything felt like it was kind of done, like, oh my God, what? Whew! And some of them took years to come back. And what we saw for sure, what I could tell you, is a ton of trauma.
Yeah.
We looked into the eyes of fathers and families and kids. We went to Guatemala to see, like, the trauma was unbelievable. And, you know, we get lost in this and you forget the people. You forget. I remember that we had this rare access. We were the only journalist in a detention center, and we were sitting. And I remember talking to these fathers, and because it was men, we had access to the men at that time. And at a certain point, I'm interviewing them in Spanish. For the most part, there was from other countries. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at Christina and kind of thinking, did we ask everything? We asked about this. We asked how much time. Does he know his kids? Does he get phone calls? What does he think? And then I remember turning to this one character, and this idea popped in my head. And he told me his kid was 4. And I asked him, can you tell me how he looks like and what is he like? Like, what does he want to do? What kind of food does he like? And then I didn't know if we'd use that in the show, but every person in those couple of days I asked told me, and it was this bittersweet of tears and laughter. And I remember us crying, and I remember us folding that setup that we had. They were walked out anyway. And there was a person there, somebody who worked there. I can't even remember if there was ICE. And I was like, she's like, what are they saying? And I kind of, because it was right, it was tears and laughter. It was like this joy of remembering my child. Mm. And I said, do you understand Spanish? And she said, no. And I remember being in tears, and I said, honestly, it's very simple, but I kind of am happy you don't, because it's too painful for me to explain at the moment. Like, it was just, so yeah, we you know, the policies you get lost at, but then there is outcome and there are people you see. And that one was definitely painful. And again, I think it falls into this idea of installing fear.
Yeah. Do you think that what you were hearing from them, that it was a deterrent at that point, where the father's saying, I'd do anything to get my kids and my wife back, we'll just go back to our country? Or were they adamant that they wanted to be in America and move forward?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think generally the idea of installing fear is one thing, but the reality is that so many of these individuals have real fears. They didn't want to leave their country.
Right.
They had to leave their country. And I think that's something that's kind of a misconception, in a way that they're coming here to ask for help because they can no longer return home.
Right. That's important to remember.
And absolutely. I think that was one thing that I think a lot of people will go to a lot of lengths, and they'll wait because they can't go home. And so I think maybe the deterrence did work in that sense, because they finally said, you know what, I just need to be with my kids. And others, no, they waited.
Right. I'm curious, in all the access you had, if there's one or a few stories that stand out to each of you where it was just so painful to watch that you could share.
There are so many.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So in that detention center, we actually had very good relationships with the agents and the person who ran the facility. And at one point they kept saying, there's this guy, there's this, there's that, and child separation was happening. And then we said, hey, is there anybody, can you just kind of say, hey, there's these journalists here and they get to sit here. Nobody gets to do this. Who wants to talk to us? And there were two women, one made the show, one not, that both broke my heart. And one was a case of Berta, who was an asylum seeker who was 63 years old. And to make a very long story short, she was the most clear non-threat to the US that anybody could be. It was a really strong asylum case that was clearly looked pretty legit. And there's a lot of asylum cases that don't. It's a huge loophole. Mm-hmm. And she was there for, I think, north of a year at that point. And we kind of like brought this, and she talked to us, and we met her lawyer through that, who's still a good friend. And we brought it back to the man who runs a detention center. And we said, why this lady? Look at this file. And he kind of listed, and this part's in the show, of all the things that he could do that he doesn't want to hold her. And actually the lawyer like checked out all these things. And yeah, I just remembered Berta being like, I just felt like they detained my grandma, who actually ran from life. And they couldn't, they were like, there was again this idea that she'll break down. But you could tell that this woman, she had helped her. She had helped her granddaughter because she was trying to be forced into marriage into the gangs. And she ran away with her. And there was a police report. Everything like fit. Mm-hmm. And I could tell she just like, just staying. She wasn't going to, like, the alternative was just worse. Mm. And I don't know, it broke my heart. There was this lady, this nun that came to visit her all the time. Sometimes in these situations, you meet people who, no matter what, they do good. These Mother Teresa figures, I'm not very religious of sort at all. And you just lean on them because you're so broke.
Yeah.
There were cases like that. There was another lady that we didn't publish that clearly had an asylum story of abuse. And they just get lost in this pretty vicious system. And there's a ton of stories that, you know, I could see why they shouldn't be let in, and it all gets confusing, but you do meet so many people who you're like, oh my God.
Right. Have you followed up with her story? Do you know whatever happened to her?
She got deported, and she actually 63 years old, got deported, and she actually made it back and tried again. And to me, it was just this like, who does that if you're not
meaning right? She you're legally right. Tried to come in now, filling out the paperwork and all that stuff.
No, she tried legally the first time. She was in detention facility over a year. I can't remember. This is a long time ago.
Okay.
And eventually gets deported.
Right.
And went on a huge track back and ended up trying and got deported again and ended up trying again in Mexico to actually do it the right way, if there is such a thing. At that point, I lost track. And that granddaughter of hers actually remained in the U.S., which I think was part of, she was like kind of willing to die for that, I think.
Right.
So she, in a weird way, she saved. But yeah, I don't know where they are today. It's been a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's so hard to stay in touch. It's actually, even when they're inside the ICE kind of mechanism, we used to call it the black hole. Because people just like, because of beds and needs, for no rhyme or reason, really, they could get moved to a different detention center. They could be held a year. They could be released tomorrow, just released out to the streets, because it's so arbitrary. Maybe there's just like, they're from a country that ICE just can't deport to. ICE can't deport to countries like Cuba, Venezuela. There's a bunch. There's no agreement in place. And so you're actually holding this person in a cell that you can't do anything with. You're paying $150 a day for a tax, out of tax money, for a person to sit in a jail that's technically not a jail because he's awaiting his process, but there's nowhere to go. And it just kind of rips at you when you see how the system kind of like arbitrary. That's the word I keep coming back to.
Right. I'm curious because you see such a public display of whatever's going on right now these days where you're watching these people get detained now, especially in New York today. There's, you know, all these, there was video of last night, two nights ago with people getting walked down the street by ICE. What was that like for you guys being part of those, watching that happen, where they're just knocking on a door, surprising people in the middle of the night and taking them?
It was really hard for sure. But you have to, because we were embedding with ICE, there becomes this line that you can't cross. You know, you are a journalist, you are behind the camera. Emotionally, you have to kind of separate it and deal with the emotional side of it later, because you are there to witness this and document it. And I think that's something that we, you know, talked a lot about. We processed a lot of emotional things, but when you're actually in the moment, you just have to be present and you have to just witness. And the idea is, you know, that we're going to tell these stories, but we as journalists need to just document. Right. And, you know, I think that was kind of something that no matter how hard it was, that we tried to keep that line. And I think we did it pretty well.
Right, right.
I think we also understood them to a degree, like that specific part. Look, this unit, they, like we said, they mainly went after people who actually had a criminal record and they were here illegally. And like I said before, they want to play. Like it's a cat and mouse. And sure, you know, it was more like sad if you knock on that door and their brother's here and they like didn't do anything and they've been here for 15 years and they're going for college and you just collateral him on the way.
Yeah, right.
Legal or not, you're like, what the hell?
Right.
But yeah, I think there's harder parts to understand, Rachel. Like, I think what's really, immigration gets lumped as all as one.
Right.
The border, these criminals, there's like so much about that. Immigration is so much more. It's a DACA kid that's been here that was brought here when he was four and he's living in fear now. It's the people who are trying to do it the right way. There is no right way for most of these people to come. It's, you know, there's so many people that are living in communities that are not the border story. They've paid trillions in dollars in tax year. There's refugee resettlement. They're just legally brought here that, let's say, helped us in Afghanistan because they served in the U.S. military, that they're trying to get their families here because they were brought here in the chaos. And now this program's shut down. So I think in a weird way, seeing the knocks on the door is as upsetting as it is to people. It wasn't as frustrating because we were with the ICE agents. And I remember one of them, Judy, said, like, someone has to do the job and I'm it. And I actually understood her job. I think it's what's harder for me is that because this issue is complicated and so controversial and nobody actually wants to talk about it, we just like screaming matches, that everything gets lumped together. Mm-hmm. And then I'm an immigrant. Elon Musk is an immigrant. What is this country if not a country of immigrants? Why are we good? If we don't attract the world talent, do you think we'll be that good? Maybe some American first people think we are. I think we're much better off as an immigrant country. And that's where it gets to me more angering. Mm-hmm. This idea of like, of course we shouldn't help a refugee. Well, wait a minute, why not? They are people who've been for years recognized by the UN. They're probably, sometimes they're of a cause of our doing in different countries, and now their life's in danger. And the crime rate among refugees is like 1 to 10 to a citizen or something. Again, mm-hmm. I'm roughing up here the stat, the data. So that's what's, to me, that those things are more angering sometimes than ICE is doing their job or right. ICE is removing people. So yeah, you know, there has to be law. There has to be, any country needs immigration law. You should come here legally. You should not enter through the window. But there also has to be common sense. You know, for example, right now, one of the first thing they did is kill CBP1. That's an app that Trump started in his first administration. So instead of running through the country, you could sign up and do it the right way. If you want to ask for asylum, you're going to wait on the other side, sometimes years, in Mexico and get an appointment. So if you take the app that has makes that work, that you essentially sign up to have an appointment before coming here illegally and just kill it, I think people are just going to run across the border more. Yeah, sure. Some may say, I'm scared, it's not worth it. But it's those things anger me about immigration, not how an ICE agent effectively knock on a door.
Got it.
Yeah, I agree. And just to add to that, I think what we did see is that the ICE agents are the individuals, the one thing. But once somebody is detained and is in the system, there's a whole other set of bureaucratic black holes that they go through. You know, the lack of communication, the people not to talk to their lawyers, the backlog of waiting for a court case, the signing a document wrong or filling it out incorrectly can put your case back years, months or years. Or just the idea of a lot of the, we worked with refugees and these follow to join cases. So it's somebody that's been admitted as a refugee to the United States, waited in line, has been extremely vetted for many years. We have said, yes, you can come. Now they want to bring their family so they can apply for their family. And in this case, Deborah was applying for her 4 children and she waited for years for them. And what ends up happening is there becomes a black hole of the paperwork is that it's being chased around from office to office. They can't find it. It's somewhere here. And I think that was intentional. There's a lot of intention that was going into these bureaucratic black holes that created just a lot more mess, even beyond the fact that somebody's being detained and put in a detention center and being deported. If you want to actually keep your case going, it just extends and extends.
Christina, I'm curious, in your perspective, was there a moment that either really haunts you about what you learned and what you witnessed, or a moment that you really felt proud of what was happening?
You know, I think Deborah's story, this refugee, this woman that came to the U.S., she didn't choose to come here. Refugees don't choose where they get resettled to.
Okay.
She was burned by acid by her husband in Uganda, and she waited for a while to come as a refugee to the United States, and she filed for her 4 children. And there was an incident where we actually accompanied her to Kenya to see her children and to try. She was trying very hard to push the case forward. And I remember being with her and trying to actually go to the office where the case files were, and how she was so adamant about that if I just set foot in the country and if I just stand here and if I just demand that those case files are on somebody's desk, that will make all the difference. Mm-hmm. And in her situation, I think it helped move the case forward. Mm-hmm. I think that she's just one of the strongest people I know. And she waited and she pushed and she fought and she never gave up. And I think that was really kind of a small light in a lot of darkness.
Right. Right. Okay. So I know you guys don't make policy and all this stuff, but you guys are highly educated and you guys have been in the middle of this and seen more than most people. What is the right way? How is this going to transpire going forward?
Well, those are two different, what's going to happen and what's the right way is quite different.
All right. Well, let's start with what is the right way?
Obviously, this is my personal opinion.
Yeah.
Look, like I said before, I think this country is better off with immigrants. I think it's very sad that we talk to immigrants, lump them all together, talk to them as all their rapists and murderers. And, you know, when you have millions of people, you're going to have a lot of kinds of people. I think if you really want to change the immigration, look, we haven't had an immigration reform since 1996 because the two parties can't talk about this issue. So none of the ways that you're supposed to come to this country make any sense. The visa programs, everything is kind of broken.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to control who's coming here, which I think we all want, you have to get realistic about it and let people do a right way. This is a slogan that's being used, but I gave now this CBP1 example. Like, we need, I'll give you the answer for examples. We covered Panama City had a hurricane when we were doing Immigration Nation, a very strong one. And a lot of undocumented people came and started working to rebuild the houses of people. This is a very Trump area, very conservative, right? And there was clearly a need for them. Most of the people needed those people. There wasn't other people to sit on the roof at whatever hot it was and do the work. Yeah, at the same time, when you went to Home Depot, we saw the police raid it. There is an irony of there's farming. There is a lot of need for work. There is a lot of, like I said, the more prestige visas of attracting talent here. You know, and on the flip side, to those who just want America first, let's remove everybody, I would caution, without getting into the details, that no matter what you do, that policy is not very achievable for an array of reasons, which I can explain, but will take a while.
Mm.
So to simplify a complicated issue, I think the common sense thing would be to say, okay, listen, there's some people, like these DACA people, we've been monitoring them since the Obama days. They've came here as children. It was not their decision. And most of them are more American than I am at this point. They've paid their taxes. We've had them on these programs. They check in. Why aren't we taking this 800,000 people and getting them off this blacklist of 12 or 14 or however million people who are in limbos and shadows? The goal is to have less people in the shadows and deport some of the people who shouldn't be here. And the main goal is to not let people come here the wrong way or illegally. Sure. But in order to achieve that, and this is where I probably differ from, because I'm kind of people think we may be very left on immigration. I'm not. I'm an immigrant. I did it the right way, but I had that rare opportunity because of the luck of where I'm from and because of my talent. And I don't know if I would have that today, quite frankly. So if you don't allow people to do it the right way, especially the more common workers, those who build after hurricanes, those who milk the cows, those who pluck the chickens, and I can go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, those people, there's a lot of pluses in what they do for this economy, taxes. They're going to do it the wrong way. And we're going to have a problem. And no matter how much you want to enforce and scare, and guess what? When you enforce and scare, while it could have an effect of moving people, you're also creating people in fear and in poverty. They're more susceptible to do bad shit.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, you know, it's this hammer and a olive leaf at the same time to me as a solution. There are programs that I agree, and some of my friends at the immigrant community would be upset with me saying, but there's a thing called TPS, temporary protected status. A lot of people are under it. And basically it says, if your country has suffered from a really bad thing right now, you don't have to file for asylum. You're collectively every 18 months, we kind of like reassess if it's safe to go back. So Haiti is under TPS now and Trump wants to cancel it. Some countries have been under TPS for so long, it just doesn't make sense. Now, again, the flip side is, wait a minute, these people have been here for years. If somebody's been here for 15 years and they're from El Salvador, there's other examples. Should I look in and see if they're law-abiding citizens that pay taxes, that got married, that, you know? And I think there's such an extreme and polarization about this subject that everybody is just stuck in showing the other side.
Right.
When the arbitrary and grief that it creates is horrific. And if I believe I got to mention one more example, because this is the one thing that no matter how right wing or Republican person, when I would say that, they would be like, oh, maybe you're right. Maybe the system's broken. We didn't know this, but we were standing in on the border in El Paso Juarez one day. And there's this event that people could get to hug each other across the border that they can't meet, and separated families just, and it's been happening forever. And one of the guys said, you know, my daughter didn't want to come today, but I'm here to help just to see. And he started talking to Christina, and he said, and his English was perfect and stuff. And he was like, I'm a US Marine. And I was like, you're full of shit. He's like, no, there's deported veterans. I you know, you could go in to and serve in the military. And this is a small percent of people. It's not this huge issue you're going to hear about. Sure. But it just showed me, and we started following deported veterans through the show, and we actually wanted to make a movie just about them. And it showed me just how sometimes how lost we are with this subject. Because I don't think there's one Republican person I know that I talk to, we go back to where Christina is from, northern Minnesota. A lot of people think very right wing. We have these conversations all the time. And sometimes I hear him say these things about immigration, and to some I agree with, and some, but to some I'm like, what are you talking about? You're so into the argument and you know so little, and you're, and the saddest thing, you're looking so little at the person that it's hurting.
Right.
Like, really, this Marine that served, some, if it was a horrific crime, maybe you should deport him. I think put him in prison. If he served your country, if he went to two tours in Iraq, then yeah, an American could be a murderer too. I'm sorry. That's why we have prisons. But some of them smoked weed. It's legal now. He's sitting in Mexico. What are we doing?
Yeah.
And the irony is, we can't solve this. So the good news about this extremely complicated, for those listening who are kind of losing their mind, yes, the details are complicated. The better news, the simplicity is, I actually think most of us can agree on a lot of it. But we have to kind of take a breath and not, and this, it's extremely hard in polarized America that we live in. And unfortunately, you asked me, what do you think is going to happen? That is clearly not what's going to happen. Because if you really want to negotiate, you don't do some of the things we're seeing in week one.
Right.
Anyway, that's my heated, I think America would be disappointed at just a strong arm. They will learn that it's very hard to deport millions and millions of people. It's going to be extremely expensive, extremely ineffective. It will cause a lot of grief. They'll have positives in it. The border is actually fairly slow. People say, oh, millions, you know, during the Trump era, millions of people crossed the border too. Mm. Our border is a rough, pretty open area. But you could build and build and spend millions. And Trump was able to build, what, a whole 50-something miles in the first? Didn't slow much down. And if you built those, you're just creating an industry for smugglers, drug cartels, to bring people. And they'll break that every time.
Right.
Like that. So these issues, like, they're so emotional. But really the solution is, if you want to stop something, maybe you should be tough when it's illegal, but make a legal way. Really fix the problem. We have 300 and something immigration judges. We need about 10,000. There's a pending, you have to wait for an immigration asylum case for an average of somewhere between 5 to 10 years. That right. should be 1 week.
Right.
So if you really need asylum, that is a loophole. I agree with the right wing on that. Most people just say asylum.
Hmm.
And my lawyer friends on the left will scream at me for saying this, but I've seen it with my two eyes.
Right.
You know, I've sat in non-detained docket. This is a unit I sat in New York that basically about 3 million people report to. The majority of people here, even undocumented, a lot of them ICE knows about, and they come to these meetings. And usually they're really scared. They're scared of being deported. They're scared of what's going to happen. Once in a while, we would sit, and these agents, the ICE agents, became our friends. And he was like, you see how everybody's nice to me and careful? This next guy, he's going to walk in. He's going to be an asshole. He can put his feet on my desk. You know why? Because he's from Cuba. He understands that there's no way, because of the way the law is set, I'm going to be able to deport him. And he's violent. Look at his crimes. And he would show me. He beat up his wife. He's doing this. And at that point, I was like, oh my God, you have to deport this guy. He's a clear criminal. And he was a true ass when he came through that door. And so all these examples are really caused a lot by our inability as a country to step back and say, we agree on most of this, and there is common sense of most of this, but because it's such a hot cake, we haven't been able to have the right and the left in Congress since 96 take and say, okay, this is how you get visas. This is the numbers of visas you get. There's the same numbers of visas for different countries like Mexico and Israel. That doesn't make any sense. That's your neighbor. You have a huge workforce. We're a tiny country. I'm originally from Israel. You know, it's all little examples to show how broken the system. I've never met someone who knows a system as right wing or as left wing as they got that didn't think that the system is broken.
Hmm.
Not one.
So I'm curious, most of Americans are getting their information from this, from the media, right? Because they're not necessarily taking the time to do all the research and obviously don't have the access that you did. What would be the one thing you would change about how the media covers immigration in general?
You know, it's always a hard question because the media is this big word. I see a lot on Fox News that they say, but covered in the media. And I'm like, you are the media. You're the biggest media in the country. What are you talking about? Mm. So, you know, it gets covered quite like, right, this media is, and I'm the media. Mm-hmm. But Immigration Nation on Netflix is part of the media, maybe more an entertainment company, but that doc is part of Yeah, so again, it comes back to this point of this is emotional and it's okay to be emotional. It's actually a good thing. If you're not emotional, if you don't care, that's worse. But I wish it would be covered a little bit more. Yeah, and I don't even know if it's not. You know, I'm hesitant, as you can tell, to kind of blame my partners in the media. Like all of us, we have better and worse and great and bad days where I think a lot of the information is out there. I don't think we want to hear or digest it really. And because it does get complicated, as you can hear, I like give you all these examples, but I'm trying to simplify it so I don't fall too deep and not forget that Berta, that deported veteran, that Or even that ICE agent that gets hated. And maybe he is doing an okay thing. Or maybe he's just a cop that took a federal job and that's the mandate. So I'm a little bit careful about the media's role because I don't really think they're that at fault, if that makes sense.
It does.
I think we as a country as a whole thing on that media debate is at fault.
Right.
We're very polarized. And I personally think we're in very dark days when it comes to immigrants. I absolutely despise the rhetoric of this administration about how they talk about immigrants. To me, the U.S. is much stronger as a country of immigrants. I think that is actually part of the fabric of its dream. And I think this rhetoric and I think a lot of them know that, I know they know they can't just, there's not a solution just by deporting and being tough. That is a pitch that's wrong.
Right.
It's just not, they could say it all they want and we can meet in 4 years and I could say, I told you so.
Right.
So what they are doing is there's a lot of installing of fear, but in that they're demonizing and they're lumping all these people together. They're lumping people that, look, I don't have a fear per se. I've been a citizen, what, for like over 10 years. I've been here 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I could feel traveling in some places. And I'm a journalist and I'm people who know me, like I'll put it all out there. But I could feel already a tone in the difference of like, shut up. You don't have a right to talk. You're not from here.
Hmm.
Or why do you think you did it? You know, I could just feel the tone. And yeah, to that part, everything I'm trying to merge, but to that part where we're going, and this has been a process for a while, there's no win for Americans.
Right.
I don't care if you're right or left. Being brutal, demonizing, not realizing actually the different people it affects, the way it affects our economy, saying slogans of like solving a solution by a military and power that is limited by, it's part of the solution. That's where I think we're really wrong. Our inability to talk, to chill it down, and a basic argument, which is an argument. I don't think it takes, there is like frustration with whatever it is and putting it on the migrant. Crime, economy. I mean, it's clearly part of Trump's pitch.
Right.
And it clearly works. And this country is clearly upset about it. And then they're upset about the people. And they say, oh, just do it legally. They always say it, but they're killing the legal programs and they're upset with people who are doing it legally. They're not letting it. They've shut up. Who are you to talk? And it's kind of ironic because then they all like look at the Statue of Liberty and the meaning of their grandparents coming in here. And it's the same.
Right.
And it's what you're so proud of that made this country.
Right.
And there's the irony there that you're just like, what the hell?
Right. Yeah. Doesn't make sense. Do you think that you, is this something you want to do a part two to? Do you want to get involved in revisiting this ever again in a documentary form?
Until a month ago, I would have said, no way, Jose. We've done a base jumping and a Shaun White show, and we're looking at these things to some degree. We just had a child, and I feel like we fought a large fight and told the story.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we won't have access to ICE, which is fine. They felt that, I think we did a fair and balanced job, and it just showed a painful process of a lot of things I described, but they felt hurt by it, and that's fine. But the real answer is, I think so. I think it's this weird curse of doing what we do. As we grow, I just celebrated my 50th, and I've been doing this job for 30 years, and I was like, just do the fun things. Maybe sell. It's not what the networks want. Mm-hmm. But I find myself caring. We spend time in Ohio now in the refugee center that we talked about. And I think if we do this, we would want to focus on actual legal immigration. That huge part. Refugees is a part of it. not lumping it all together. People like this past week, I met all these people who were in Afghanistan, and I was interviewing this guy and on camera, and I asked him, you know, were you vetted? What did you do for the military? Did you ever see action? And he kind of went like this and lifted his shirt and showed me the scar from the IED. And he was like, here's a number. I opened my cell phone, Sergeant blah, 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 Special Forces, call them. They'll tell you who I am and what I did for the U.S. military for, I can't remember if he said 12 years or 14. And I suddenly found myself, I was like, oh no, here we go again. Me and Christina are going to do this, aren't we? We're going to like, I don't know if somebody wants to buy it. I don't know what we're doing here, but it feels like it matters.
Right. It's an important story to be told.
And so, yeah, I can't predict the future. This just started. And to some degree, I hope we don't. I hope, you know, we were thinking of doing a show with Novak Djokovic or like mm-hmm. other stuff, which are great, because I realize that sometimes in hard times, people actually want entertainment. They want to escape. And it's okay to make that.
Right.
But something burns inside us. And I think it's partially the mix that we're an American and immigrant turned American. I think it's everything we saw through being, I don't think anybody ever had access to ICE the way we did. And again, we actually walked away that we don't, people are like, you hate ICE agents. I was like, no, maybe the top of the administration disliked us. I have a lot of the ICE agents are my friends, literally today. I could call them and talk to them and everything because we were in it with them. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're still drawn in, but I think to me the biggest thing would be to kind of do something about troubles being caused to people who are doing it the right way.
Mm.
If the solution starts with, people think it starts with enforcement, but if you just do enforcement, you're not going very far.
Right.
So can we focus on the right way when it works and when it doesn't, and makes people knowledge a little bit more on whether it's refugees, whether it's the right visas, whether it's how our system's built. But yeah, so we're researching that as a short. We're researching three projects, and one of them is about immigration. But this started a month ago. We really resisted it.
Right.
We're writing our first fiction film based on true events, which is artistically really satisfying after being just a journalist for 30 years, or not just, sure. but like doing with. So it's a new form. So, you know, I think in a freelance creative life that we live, you kind of like plan these things, but then certain destiny and what kind of clicks in a way takes the role. And certainly if we end up doing something else, I'll be fine, because I think a lot of people are going to deal with immigration. And I think they should. And I actually think it's going to keep dominating the news. And
yeah.
I do think we're going to see, you know, this administration is brand new. We're going to see a lot of things go under.
Right.
And into question and into big legal fights. And unfortunately, I will be shocked. Like, I don't think this is going to get close to being better.
Right. For those of you listening, Immigration Nation is on Netflix. You must see it if you haven't seen it yet. It's fantastic. It's heart-wrenching. It's all sorts of things. But Shaul, you did an amazing job with Christina on that. I am in awe of all the work that you always do. I think you guys are both fabulous, and I do wish you the best of luck. I cannot wait to see what is next. If people are interested in following more about you or reaching out to you, where can they find you?
You can Google us and literally call. Or email. We do listen to stories. We're like always listening for an immigration story or a different story or a people experience. We're independent people, and we're quite a good journalist never stops listening, and we're certainly that.
That's right. All right, my friend, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rachel, you're amazing and always fun to chat to. Keeping it real and honest and light and kind of.
Thank
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled M-I-S-S, understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Ka'Chava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to ka'chava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.